that their art would be seized and destroyed. Now, thankfully, you know, our understanding is that Mr. Alawi was able to take much of his art with him to Oman. And he looks forward to continuing with that skill set to express himself.
We just have about a minute. What does Biden need to do? He has, what, just over a week left?
Guantanamo has always been a question of political will. Biden actually has an opportunity to do more than he has already done. Perhaps the single most remarkable thing about the transfer of the 11 prisoners this week is that there has been complete silence from the Republican camp. And that's because Guantanamo is no longer as politically valuable as it once was. The Republican, and this may be the depressing way of looking at it, the Republicans have so thoroughly won on every front, including with the last election, that they no longer need to beat up the Democrats over Guantanamo. And in that lies an opportunity for President Biden.
And even with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, the $500 million spent on a prison for what, it's now 15 men, Pardis? Your final comment.
And concretely, there are 6 of the 15 men have never been charged, will never be charged. 3 of those men have been cleared for transfer and are awaiting transfer. Those men should be transferred at a minimum, and that includes a CCR client who remains, Guli Duran Hassan from Somalia. At a minimum, this DOJ should drop its opposition to their habeas cases, to the habeas cases of anyone who will remain.
And are you calling for the prison to be closed?
We are calling for the end of the system of indefinite detention to close, and they are very close to doing that. That can be done.
We're going to leave it there. Pardis Kabriai is a senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and attorney Ramzi Qasem is a professor at CUNY Law School. Their clients are Yemeni prisoners just transferred to Oman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal, and we'll be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. Join the team.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
There's no post-colonial, we live in, they will not Answer for Kate is fire. It burns from our hearts. So long as we hold it inside, they can never take this from us.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Roland. And that was the inimitable Klee Benally on the At the Edge of This World from Respect Existence or Expect Resistance. We lost Klee just about exactly a year ago. So much has happened, it seems like a long time further than that. Around early January of last year. And of course, Klee was a fellow citizen of the Navajo or Dene Nation, along with my co-host this morning, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
So before we get into anything, I have an announcement to make. I think it's going to stick. I've been my mother's been having increasing difficulties, and I won't go into all that, but I've been her primary caregiver for many years. And anyway, just for a lot of reasons, I feel the need just to take an extended leave of absence. I hope I can stick to that and take care of some things at home and take care of myself. So probably with your show next month or a little bit after, we'll see. I'll be back, but I'm going to take about a month off to so my listeners know that that's what's happening. This is I don't know. I say every week now. This is a very propitious and intense weighty time, and this is no different. Now we are also looking back on the 4 years after January 6th with the incoming Trump, who instigated January 6th, although, of course, the story has been pretty much, if not totally rewritten, at least where it counts in the places of power, the seats of power, it's been pretty much rewritten. And you want to talk about that, I know, and also revisit your book, Standoff, Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement and the American Story of Sacred Lands, in relation to that. And also in relation to the we watching the world burn to the ground, you also wanted to look at the intense fires. It's like a hurricane of fire, they say, down in Southern California. So good with all that, good morning to everybody.
Good morning. That's what. Yep.
So what do you want to start off with?
Well, gosh, I was really, really touched by your thoughtful introduction about Klee. And, you know, I just, I think for a long time I was sort of pushing it away because I just couldn't accept that he was gone. And it just felt like he still had so much more work to do. And his voice is such a unique and really, really valuable perspective. I bought his he published a book before he died, and I bought a copy of it. And I actually, to be honest, I haven't read it yet because I feel like once I read it, you know, then he will be truly gone. That's just this is weird feeling I have, you know. But obviously, I'm really glad he wrote a book before he died, and it just, you know, yeah, it's just so much. I mean,
No, I just want to mention the title of the book before we go further.
Sure, go ahead.
No Spiritual Surrender, Indigenous Anarchy in Defense of the Sacred. There it is.
Yeah. It was just really incredible. I mean, and I'm just so glad he took the time to write down his thoughts and his philosophy because we had the good fortune of having him as a guest on the show many times, and I definitely love listening to his voice and his thoughtful, you know, perspective on things. And I think it was really just this, a couple of months ago, I started to really come to terms with the fact that he was gone. And the fact I had, before he died, I guess it was December 31st of 2023, I was in Flagstaff. He lived in Flagstaff. And I was there just a few months earlier, therefore, and, you know, visiting, my mom's family is from Cameron, which is just north on the Navajo Nation of Flagstaff. So we do tend to go through there when we're going back to the res. And I thought about visiting him, but I was just kind of with my family in a rush, you know, and dealing with a lot of things. And when you're on the road with your relatives. And so I just didn't look in on him. And I really regret that. I mean, I just wish I would have done that. And I didn't know he was in the hospital at that time. And I would have found out if I had bothered to do that. And I mean, he definitely was on my mind when I was there. I just didn't have the time, you know. So it's just I mean, and I know that I interviewed him on my own show I had a show on KBOO for, I started it actually a year after the January 6th,
onslaught insurrection.
Yeah. And it was called American Standoff. And you can, I was just looking at it the other day because I'm writing a piece about the anniversary, the 4-year anniversary of that. And, I hadn't realized I had done so many, I only meant to do the show for 6 months and I ended up doing it for a lot longer, a year and a half or something. And so there's like 5 pages of shows on there and I was a little surprised. I didn't realize that. I think, you know, having him on the show and having him talk about his thoughts and his ideas. I also had him on my podcast, Pollination, as well. But he was just, and we had actually worked, I've been working on finishing a book about Robert Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project and his impact on the Navajo Nation. And of course, he did a lot of work against, you know, against uranium mining and the hauling of uranium across the Navajo Nation, the No Haul movement, and of course, protecting San Francisco Peak there in Flagstaff. He contributed to my anthology about Bears Ears. He contributed a chapter there about their work fighting for San Francisco Peak as a sacred mountain, which was being basically the snow machines that operate on the snow ski resorts there. They were using sewage water, treated sewage water, to make snow, artificial snow, and it just man-made, I guess. But yeah, it doesn't clean everything out. Like there's a lot of, you know, people take medication. There's all kinds of stuff that gets in that water, and you know, that's a sacred area. And those plants are also quite the native plants there are, you know, it's just not okay to be dumping that on the land just for recreation purposes. And so he really fought really hard for that. But we worked on that book, which is now titled Letters to Oppenheimer, but she worked with me on initially, I guess his health got bad, so he wasn't able to continue. So when I finish that book, I will you know, we created all the chapters together. And so when I get that book done, you'll definitely have a huge, you know, kind of a remembrance and thanks. Thank you to him, the opening of the book.
Well, and, I just pulled up a copy of his book actually online, and I thought I'd just maybe read the. It has a picture of the title "No Spiritual Surrender: Indigenous Anarchy in Defense of the Sacred" by Clee Benally, and then he writes, "Our ceremonial offerings of hopelessness become the destruction of faith in the transformation of a societal order manufactured on our destruction. In other words, a degeneration of settler colonial progress. The most bitter medicines are the strongest. We end despair by ending what is causing our suffering, destroying what destroys us. After all, anti-colonial means anti-settler society." That's really interesting formulation. Our ceremonial offerings of hopelessness become the destruction of faith in the transformation of a societal order manufactured on our destruction. And I think as we go into another Trump presidency, I think examining hopelessness, the cycle of hope and hopelessness, and how maybe at the bottom of whatever we're thinking, there is a kind of a hopelessness about real change. So we continually reiterate some of the same tried and failed formulations of change. That's the way I look at it anyway. And the underlying how maybe we, despite ourselves, we really do not believe. I think of the quote, we it's easier for us to believe in the end of the world than the end of capitalism. The entrenched nature of, you know, whether we identify the colonial history, whether I identify the capitalist dynamics. Go ahead.
Yeah, this goes back to the creation story that I talk about in my book Standoff, which I look at the creation stories, the origin stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and the world itself, and how that really sort of outlines what direction we're going to take in the world. And I call those algorithms that there's embedded in the origin stories of a people. And so the colonial origin story is exactly like what you're describing, you know, and has the exact, so this kind of apocalyptic ending is the ending that's foretold in their stories of who they are as a people. But the Navajo way, which is what Clee, of course, you know, really advocated for, has a very different story of a people. And I think that when you look at I mostly looked at the origin story in Standoff of my father's people, of the Dakota and Lakota people. But because embedded in these origin stories, sort of like this, it tells you who you are, what your role is, what your relationship is to our mother, the earth, you know, and to all the other people, all the other creatures and living beings that live on this planet and live on as part of our mother, you know. And so this is why people, it's sort of, I think I described it before as sort of a, think of it as a box that you run a mouse through in a lab. It kind of directs you in a certain direction, and you end up on the other side because it's really where it's taking you. And so these sort of thoughts, you know, of this thought process of who you think you are, what your society tells you you are, what the sort of what the parameters of the world are. And of course, with Judeo-Christian culture, you have, you know, it's pretty, you know, that seems to be the end of everything is, you know, this complete destruction. And that is not so in other cultures. Like in Navajo culture, it's about harmony and balance. You know, hajo nasli, you know, this moving in beauty through the world. And so what I really found profound about Clee was, you know, you know, he talked a lot about mutual aid and the sort of notion of, you know, a Navajo culture, family, of supporting each other. And you know, before the pandemic, you know, we would talk about these things. But when the pandemic came, he was able to put those into motion. The Flagstaff, he had a, he had a center there where he helped homeless people if you hold them, the unsheltered, you know, and particularly unsheltered Native people, and had a weekly meal, and had, you know, a kitchen there, and a library, and a place where they could meet, and stage, and printing presses, all this stuff he has there at, and so it's just, he invited me there once, I think it was 2018, I was there for actually a book reading of the book that he contributed to there at Northern Arizona University, and Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, and he invited me to come to a talking circle there, and it was really moving to me. I felt, I felt, you know, sort of like, what do I have to tell these folks who are really struggling on the street? You know, I haven't really struggled that way myself, and I was really fortunate with my family and the support I got, and from my Native parents, my Native family, and my Dineh family, and so I just, you know, but it was really amazing to talk to them, and it was just, I'm so grateful that he gave me that experience, and you know, I was able to talk to them about a surprise that other Navajo people didn't know about our history as warriors. You know, I was in a talking circle, one of the Navajo men, he said to me, you know, I don't, you know, your father's people, you know, the Hota Makota people, you know, they're warriors. People know that they fought up and fought for their land and everything. And I told them, I said, we did too. You know, and I showed my grandmother's aunt, she wrote a book called Big Horse the Warrior, which is all about my grandmother's grandfather and how he fought for the Navajo Nation, for the Dine Ta, and he fought with Chief Manuelito, and it's all about that. And so I told, and things, this Navajo man who grew up on the res didn't know this history. It was surprising to me, and so I sent that book to Cle, and Cle added it to a library there, so this man could read about his own history, about how we fought for the land, you know, why we have that, why, you know, the Navajo Nation, our reservation, that's our homeland between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers. It's not, you know, often you hear some people talking about reservations being sort of throwaway land, prisons. That's not what the Navajo Nation is. That's our homeland. That's our actual homeland. And we are very blessed to live there within that space. And so, you know, so I sent that to him, and it was nice to be able to give him that sort of, you know, that sort of scaffolding to understand. I think as Native people, we don't hear our stories, and I was really fortunate to have a family that told our stories, oral stories and written stories, and that, as a child, as a Native child, you know, I think it gave me that strength to know that my ancestors did these things, that they, and to hear their perspective on history. And it just, every time I would hear those stories, it would sort of kind of prop up something inside me, make me feel like I can do this, you know. And so it was nice to be able to give that back in a way. And so,
yeah, I was thinking about the origin stories and the sense of apocalyptic. Of course, there's the, you know, the Book of Revelations itself, which is the New Testament. So it's a little different from the original origin story, which is obviously the, you know, the texts that make up the body of the Old Testament. But I think of that time period, some people call the time period of like Moses, Buddha, several other major like world historical religious figures as the Axial Age, this crucial moment, I guess, kind of like the beginning of the Iron Age. Anyway, this, and the time of empires, and this destruction of all the smaller, you know, intact kinship groups. So basically the original breakdown of kinship society, which sort of remains through, you know, even into feudalism, but in a, you know, a kind of a perverted form, really, I think. But anyway, so the sense of apocalypticism, I think is, as you say, is in the origins of those, of the beginnings of those cultures that we see as kind of the beginnings of, quote, our Western culture, the leading, you know, then to the Romans and the Greeks, and of course, the apocalyptic nature of Roman society, in its you know, its absolute brutal role in the you know, the just taking over other cultures. I've been reading a book about the, to my mother, about the Scots-Irish. and how the Scottish clan system was, you know, very different from they resisted, you know, north of Hadrian's Wall. They resisted and were able to maintain a kind of sort of ground up, more egalitarian type of society in the face of the Roman Empire. And of course, that's the story of so many, you know, kinship or tribal groups around the world in the face of that. So just that sense of, I think there's this endemic sense of fatalism in a sense. That, I guess that's where I resonated with what Klee was saying about this feeling of hopelessness. And I think it's somewhere deep in the core, you know, kind of in the face of this, you know, this can-do, you know, pragmatic, go-get-em, idea of America. There's this sort of fatalistic sense that we can't stop the endless destruction that technology wreaks. We can't stop ourselves, basically, as speaking as a, you know, as a Euro-American, we can't.
Yeah, stop. And when the goal becomes instead sort of with this apocalyptic, you know, Armageddon situation, is that, you know, if they're focused more on the next world, you know, on that rather than this world and having a space in it. And then, of course, it means that they can pursue all kinds of, destructive, capitalistic endeavors to live, just to get as much as they can materially now. And then they cheer on these figures that are sort of their heroes in these sorts of stories. And of course, that's why you have Trump, right? And Elon Musk and these folks. And so it becomes, you know, every people have these hero stories, and they do really inform you about what you want from society. And I think, getting back to my dad's family and my great aunt Ella Deloria, who wrote about Lakota and Dakota culture, she was an ethnologist trained by Franz Boas at Columbia University, and she was fluent in all three dialects of our language, and she wrote down these ahunkakas. She recorded them, and these are traditional hero stories that were told to children at night, so they could kind of, you know, get into their brains, I think those stories, they tell you how you're supposed to act in society. And in that culture, we also have, you know, the stories as well. And of course, you have the stories of the twins, who go out and, you know, they destroy the monsters to make the world safe for the people, you know. And I think that this gives you a really different idea. And of course, Diné culture is always focused on harmony, on healing, on balance, right, between the sexes, between everything that's supposed to be, everything is supposed to be in balance with each other. When you have that sort of perspective that informs your storytelling and what you're telling the children, who they are and what their role is, it really does create different pathways for society to take. And I think when Klee was able to really put into effect his mutual aid ideas during the pandemic, I was really impressed. I mean, he set up hand washing stations for the unsheltered in Flagstaff. He worked really hard to get them the right to camp, you know, without being molested. And then he really began taking out huge truckloads, semi-truckloads of supplies out to the reservation to both the Hopi and Navajo communities. And so, yeah, so it was really, you could see what traditional Diné mutual aid society, how that worked. And I think a lot of other Navajos were doing this as well at the time, and who I also interviewed during the pandemic. And it was, I think that just gives you an idea of a glimpse of what that society looks like and what it, how it operates and how it's different in many ways. Bringing this to the two topics we sort of discussed today, one is, of course, you know, the apocalyptic fires going on in Los Angeles right now. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about was because, there's a post that a friend of mine, Joshua Frank, who writes for,
Counterpunch.
Yeah, Counterpoint. He And he had asked me to do the forward to his book about the atomic age, and particularly Hanford. And but he posted last night video that they had taken on, on Instagram of driving down a Pacific Coast Highway right by the Getty Museum, and just the whole place in flames. And he wrote, a counterpunch meeting, he wrote, beyond Mike Davis's provocative title to his classic essay, The Case for Letting Malibu Burn, is a thesis that resources and attention are disproportionately allocated to save the rich at the expense of the poor. While this is historically the case, the fires raging across L.A. tonight are far worse than even the great Mike Davis could have foreseen. Schools are burning, libraries, restaurants, stores, state parks, mobile homes, apartments, power buildings, horses, mountain lions. People will die. Lives are being destroyed. Crews aren't trying to stop Malibu from burning, or the Palisades, Topanga, Pasadena, or Altadena. They can't. There is not time and no way to do so. They are attempting to save lives as the winds howl and embers fly through the canyons. This is shaping up to be a firestorm that will forever alter the city, not just the wealthy and their coastal enclaves, but all of us. The scars will run deep and be long-lasting, and of course, as Mike would have pointed out, the poorest among us will suffer the most. And so this is, you should definitely check out Counterpunch Media's Instagram feed. Thinking about that, like, how do we allocate resources? How are we taking care of our community? How is the structure of the system set up to do that? And who benefits the most and who doesn't? That's, you know, for me, I'm always looking at the structural nature of society, because I feel like there's such an inevitability about the structure that's built in. You know, whether it's the structure of white privilege, like you see with Trump, who seems to get away with everything, right? I mean, the system can't stop him, right? and the people, the white people who vote for him, and you know, they're completely on board with this. And so, and then getting to, of course, the second topic, which is about, you know, Trump pardoning the January 6th folks.
Before we do that, we're halfway through the show, and I haven't given out the number yet. This is a call-in show, and it's okay in case you're wanting to join the conversation. It's, as always, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host, and every second Wednesday I have Jacqueline Keeler, Navajo or Diné and Dakota author and activist who is in the Portland area, and comes on, as I say, once a month to talk about various subjects with me. And you are invited to call in again at 503-231-8187. About 25 minutes left, so better get your calls in earlier rather than later. So yeah, so the pardoning, and of course, just to interject, there's a show on Democracy Now. I don't know if you listened to it yesterday. She spoke with Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Joshua Kaplan about his latest blockbuster article for ProPublica, chronicling the rise of a freelance vigilante through the ranks of the right-wing militia movement in an effort to surveil and disrupt their operations. His source was this freelance vigilante named John Williams, who went undercover after being shocked by the January 6th insurrection. And it's just fascinating, and how they're basically, and it gives you a glimpse of what we might have in store. A lot of those people kind of got, a fair number of people January 6th kind of got out of politics because of, you know, just the whole experience, but there's quite a few who are unrepentant, and now possibly a lot of the leaders might be getting out. Anyway, it's worth going back and listening to that Democracy Now! From yesterday. The Militia and the Mole, reporter Josh Kaplan on infiltrating U.S. militias. Anyway.
I definitely want to watch that. That's amazing. Yeah, I think, we have, locally, a really great series on Bundyville, that was really interesting. She got into a lot of that locally here in the Pacific Northwest, looking at that. Yeah, I think it's so with my book Standoff, it was, you know, it came out a few years ago, and I guess going on what, like 3 years now, I guess, and but it basically, it took me a while to write. I started writing it about you know, after what happened in 2016 with both the Bundy takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, and then at the Indian, and later the standoff at Standing Rock over the Dakota Access Pipeline, and just north of the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, and so I had a personal connection with Standing Rock. My grandmother's grandparents and my great grandmother was raised at Standing Rock. She, her parents were the Episcopal priest and his wife, and they ran the church there at St. Elizabeth's in Wakpala on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in the South Dakota side of the reservation. So my family, even though we're Yankton and from the Yankton Sioux Reservation in southeastern South Dakota, we have a deep connection with that community, with the people of Standing Rock. And in fact, a couple of my grandmother's cousins were made tribal citizens for that reason. And they were also adopted through the traditional hookah ceremony by Chief Gall, so the people there regard us as their blood relatives, even though that we are adoptive relatives. So my family, I've always had a deep connection, and I grew up going to the cemetery in Lake Andes on my dad's reservation. It's a church where I was baptized, the Episcopal Church. And I go into a lot of history of my family's relationship to the Episcopal Church. And my grandmother's cousin, Vine Deloria Jr., also wrote a book about it, really going into that history and our family's relationship. And he explains how one of our ancestors, named Sosway Deloria, he had a vision. He was a very powerful medicine man from a young age. From like 13 years of age, he came into his power. And this is before the Americans came. And then as an adult, he had a vision when he was 13 and basically following that vision, he made a determination that his son would become an Episcopal priest. And that our family would do this for four generations in order to protect the people and, spiritually. And so this is why our family took this role. And my grandmother's, uncles, both of them were Episcopal priests in Pine Ridge. Her uncle, her mother's brother, Brian Deloria Sr., was the Episcopal priest there. And then her father's older brother, the Reverend Charles Cook, he was the Episcopal priest there during the Wounded Knee Massacre. And he is the one who turned his church into a hospital and took the wounded Lakota people in. And he rode out in a blizzard for 2 days. With Dr. Charles Eastman, who was also a Dakota man, and they rode out for 2 days into the blizzard looking for survivors, and brought them back and tended to them because the army wouldn't allow them in the military hospital, so they had to do that there, and it was very traumatic for of course all of the Lakota people. It's like a wound, and yeah, my grandmother, she had this large portrait of him, and it was rolled up, and she took it out, and she told me how he had died just a few years later. And in our family story, she said it was of a broken heart because of what he had seen there. And I wrote about this actually just recently in the San Francisco Chronicle last month when I was talking about the boarding schools. And his younger brother, my great-grandfather, he went to Carlisle Indian School. And so when I wrote the book, I was exploring this family history, and that's why I got into the origin stories of the Dakota and Lakota people. Like, how does it drive what we do, how we survive, how we resist, how we exist, right? And so I contrasted that with the origin stories that are driving people like the Bundys, right? A colonial story, a story of being a colonist and their rights as colonists, right? And so, I definitely see. By the time I finished the book, you know, Trump was in office. And the Hammonds, who were the ranchers who the Bundys had come over to fight for, who basically were sentenced to prison for creating, for burning public lands without any permits. They were for arson and endangering the lives of many people. They were released, and they were greeted by a millionaire, and he flew them home in a private jet. And I just felt like that was a really ominous sort of what it portended for the future, for the power of the colonial story, right? And how that will drive American politics. And so even though I'm not discounting the resistance, what happened at Standing Rock. Of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline is running now. It was built and continues to be a source of anxiety to the people in those communities. And of course, the Keystone XL pipeline, which was also fought, was Trump hit. This was one of the first things he did when he got into office, was basically to approve those two pipelines, the Keystone, which I had covered before. A Yankee Sioux tribal member, one of my dad's relatives there, she led the fight against that. I started covering that in 2013. And then of course the Dakota Access Pipeline. And then of course my previous book was about Bear's ears. And at the end of his first year in office in December, he flew to Salt Lake in order to basically reduce the size of Bear's ears by 80%, which was an effort by several Native nations in the Southwest, a grassroots effort, basically to make that a national monument, because it has a lot of sacred sites and historical archaeological sites, and some of them is sacred to all of these tribes. And so the two things I was dealing with, Trump directly worked to oppose, and so I think it's worthwhile, looking at these origin stories and how they direct people to understand their world, because I think it's the only way you can really begin to address it mm-hmm. effectively. So anyway, so I'm looking. I want to maybe hear your thoughts, but I want to address the CBS News poll that came out about what Americans think about pardoning the December 6th rioters.
Well, we do have a caller who's been waiting on the phone for a bit. Maybe we could that's okay. Go quickly to Mark, and if you want to join the conversation after Mark, please call 503-231-8187. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for your passion. I hope your time away will be strengthening and reinvigorating.
Thank you.
For you. To me, from my understanding, the end, from a liberation theological perspective, the end is when God is all in all. It's not a time of destruction. I have an important question. Did you listen to Trump's horrendous press conference the other day? I think he made some defamatory statements about Jack Smith. He accused him of killing people, and my question is whether this is actionable. It's certainly not supportable speech.
Well, I don't think either of us are lawyers, so
But I wanted to raise that question. Maybe the bully has met his match in himself.
Good luck with that. We've probably said that to ourselves over and over for years now.
Why can't he take 10 days off,
Good luck with that.
Give us a chance to breathe again.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Okay, he's not going to take any time off. Anyway, thanks, Mark, and we're going to have another caller in a minute. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, well, I mean, having tried to pursue defamation lawsuits myself and as a journalist being hit with a slap lawsuits, I can tell you that defamation is very hard to prove for a public person. The laws are not good. And I think that for Jack Smith, the issue is that you have to prove that Trump actually knows that he's lying. You have to, what is it called? Oh, this is terrible. But anyway, and... And, you know, I think this was actually hard even in the Bundy case when they were being tried here in Portland, was to prove that they actually knew the law was like you had to know that you were doing it. Because they have this other worldview, they don't know things, right? There's things they just don't know. And but also with Jackson, if he tried to do that, he would be hit. One of Trump's power moves, of course, is he's able to activate his base and get them to harass people. And that is quite frightening to people. And so I don't know that Jack Smith would want to go through that. Yeah. And it's ridiculous enough to, you know, I mean, people, it's like, I think it's what Trump said early on in, when he was running for the White House the first time. He basically, he can go, he's so popular, he can go in the street and shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and there's no, he won't face any, the people will still support him. Well, and I think that's still true.
Well, speaking of his base and leading up to addressing this poll about what people think of the pardons, I just want to quote a little bit from this introduction to the Democracy Now! Piece. Kaplan says Williams' infiltration of the militia movements revealed the militia movement is surging across the country despite the failed 2021 insurrection. Now with Donald Trump promising to pardon many of the Capitol riot participants, the same movement appears set to expand even further over the next few years. Quote, the ramifications could be massive, says Kaplan. They have the potential to trigger a renaissance for militant extremists. And of course, relating back to the militias involved in the Bundy standoff and all that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of those folks here in the Pacific Northwest, militia enclaves as well.
Well, let's before we do get to that poll, maybe we'll just go to our next caller, Edie. Go ahead, sure. You're on the air, Edie.
Good morning. I'm so grateful you're having people look at what are your creation stories, what's your belief or myth or operating instructions for how the world is, and why you are the way you are or where you're going to go to is so, so important. You have to look at that continually. And it's not necessarily what Coca-Cola and marketing may say, that only when you buy this product will you be happy and fulfilled and healthy and gorgeous and everything. But in the King James Version of the Bible, I think there are 32 different creation stories. And they have two opposites, chapter 1 and chapter 2 and 3. Chapter 1, verse, and the older one that was shared by many different religions and national groups was what we kind of consider Adam and Eve, and there's different morals from that, from different perspectives. But the much newer one, the priestly account, had a different name for God, not Elohim, but is Elohim or Him, which is in Aramaic, mother, father, and that everything is created spiritually and is good, and that we are made in God's image and likeness, and we are each male and female, whole and complete, and that there is not domination, but dominion of mutual harmony and mutual respect and love. And that's totally different perspective, which is liberating someone from sin, disease, and death, from oppression. And being oppressed or being an oppressor is what the first chapter is about. And having people look, wait a minute, those are two opposites. And what
well, I think what we're discussing is not like literal, like a theological review of it, but it's like the cultural understanding of it. And yes. The cultural understanding is pretty clearly, you know, based in, for many years, of course, Christians weren't even allowed to read the Bible. It had to be interpreted to them by the priestly class. And it was actually against the law to actually publish it and stuff. But it was, I think that the issue is that the understanding of it by the general public is a certain way, you know, which is that, of course, for centuries, you know, Eve was blamed for the fall of man, and deserving of suffering and pain in childbirth and otherwise, and having to take leadership of Adam, you know, all this stuff. And I think that's the clear cultural understanding of that, of what the origin story is.
That bias was intended to have a certain result in people's thinking and behavior, and then that was exploited some more. And I'm just thinking that if any of the listeners are curious about the Bible and looking back at what of spiritual import or relevance it has, can rethink things, because just as that says, hey, stop and think, don't take anything for granted, think it through, make it logically, spiritually consistent, and we can do that, and that has repercussions then in our economic, political, environmental
changing our story does. Yeah, I think that's what I sort of come to terms with at the end, is that we need to create a new algorithm and the way pathways in which we can reach that mutually to one that we can, that will basically serve us and take care of all of us and the planet, our mother, as a group, as a large, you know, multicultural group, I think is the pathways we must seek. We must find our way to. And so I do agree with that. But I think that what I'm talking about is what's really going on, what actually people believe now, and why that's causing what we're seeing today.
So,
and why Trump is back in power, and why we're rewriting the history, why many voters are rewriting, the Republican voters are rewriting the history of January 6th.
Do you have a final thought, Edie, before we let you go?
No, I just am so grateful for both of you, your character, your lives, and the ideas and research you bring to us. We can't ever rethink it too much and then act with that courage and that integrity and compassion. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I guess as Mark said, that the task is not to understand history, but to change it. Because so I think this a lot. I think so. The idea of changing. So the idea of the original creation story that Edie brought up, there's like different versions in the Bible, and which one predominated was a result of, as she called it, bias, or you call it cultural understanding. But how did that get to impose itself? It's through these dynamics of power, you know, the origins of empires. So it's the dynamics of power that's the real problem, that we can assert a different story all we want, but how do we get that to spread? How do we get that to predominate? You know, it's a matter of we're contesting power, and unfortunately, these militias and Trump, they are operating at a level of they want to return to a brute exercise of power. So that's what we have to contend with. Anyway,
I just want to say that I feel like what we're contending with is the pathway in which they reach that story. And it's the storytelling that's going on, and that's what's happening in social media, that's what's happening in these militia groups, is that they're sharing a story with each other, and that story is then directing them in a certain way. And it's like I said, when, you know, I've spoken about this a bit, but, you know, when I was looking at the exit polling for when Trump won in 2016, I noticed that like 90% of white men with just a high school education voted for Trump. That's 9 out of 10, and that means that it's not an individual thing. So this story, I mean, that any of us who would be in that demographic class, that we would have a 90% chance of voting for Trump, and that says something about the power of our situational context, culturally, socially, educationally. And we're looking at the polling, the exit polling data for 2020. I'm seeing again, or 2024. I'm seeing again that once again, it's, you know, education does make a difference, even with white men in the exit polling for the last election.
The problem is we don't have time to revamp the educational system so that we re-educate.
Well, this
people.
Is why storytelling is really important, I think.
Right. No, it's how much ability we have to make our story become more predominant. And how do we do that? It's not necessarily what we say, it's how we're able to...
I think we have to understand that it is a storytelling issue, and that the origin story itself is the issue. I think there hasn't been that, because a lot of times there hasn't been a lot of discussion about it in the media, and also because the framework that people are avoiding is the framework of racism, right? Because this is a white people issue, right? They really spent a lot of time during the campaign talking about how, or after the election, about how black men had shifted, you know, a few percentage points, or Hispanics and stuff, or whatever. But the issue, or even Native Americans, this crazy poll, which is totally inaccurate, came out claiming that 60% of Native Americans supported Trump, which was, once again, white people claiming to be Indians on the phone, you know, and putting their thumb on the scale, trying to make Indians look like white people, right? And so I think that the issue of so we're looking at the polling of people who support the pardoning of January 6th folks. What the polling found was that the percentage of Republicans who strongly disapprove of the January 6th attack has dropped more than 20 points since January 2021. So from 51% to 30% now. And so it has really changed. I mean, basically the storytelling that's been going around January 6th within these siloed circles of information has basically pushed up the approval rating of what happened. And so the CBS YouGov poll found that support for Trump pardoning those who forced their way into the Capitol, 41% would support this and 59% would oppose. Mm-hmm. And of course it's much higher for Republicans, 72% support pardoning them and only 28% oppose it. And so they didn't break this. I tried to find the racial breakdowns of these polls, but this poll did not provide that. But definitely, since most Republicans are white people, this is, once again, you know, it's about the storytelling that whiteness has. And certainly mainstream media has not been willing to talk about that.
We've got another caller, probably our last caller. Go ahead if you're still with us, Santiago.
Yeah, good morning. I think I kind of showed up to the conversation late, but I just wanted to say I think the discussion of creation stories is so important, you know, because, the thing is that whiteness doesn't exist. It's a power construct. Whiteness has changed over time. So the people who were, there were people with white skin who weren't considered white, they were brought into the fold. But I think more importantly is that it's poetic that the Jewish creation story is co-opted by white people. So their creation story is not tethered to reality. Whereas with indigenous folks and African folks, because a lot of us are so clued in to our creation stories that we're more grounded and more connected to the earth in that way. But I also think too, because, Jackie was talking about, Jacqueline was talking about Christianity. You know, there's a really interesting quote that I really love from James Cone. He talked about black theology and black power. He talked about the idea that the black Christianity is different from white Christianity because black folks came to the Bible through the cross, whereas white folks came to the cross through the Bible, and that we see our oppression in the same, that black and brown folks see our oppression in the same way that we see, Jesus's oppression, you know, because we were all hung from, because, you know, they didn't, the cross is kind of like what people have gathered around, but in the Bible it says he was hung from a tree, okay, you know? We see ourselves, hey, black and brown folks, indigenous folks, we see ourselves hanging from the tree, in the same way that we see Jesus hanging from the tree. White people can't understand that because their savior is not hanging from a tree.
Okay, we got to let you go on that note. Like we're out of time. Thank you for calling, as always, Santiago. Last thoughts, Jackie? We got to go in a minute.
That was really interesting. I don't think I had time to respond to it. I thought that was very interesting. I love the idea of Black Christianity being different because of their approach to it being through suffering, you know, through very, you know, vicious, violent suffering through white colonial supremacy. And so, yeah, I think, you know, and I love that it happened, but I think that's a very instructive way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. And so our conversation is just about over for today. I've been speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, as always, on the second Wednesday. She's been talking about January 6th and the creation story of colonialism versus the creation story of indigenous and other folks, and her book Standoff, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands. Thank you, Jackie. I'll be back in a little over a month. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public